Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 29, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home studio in just north of New York City. And Taylor, you know what I was doing this morning, right?
I have an inkling.
The war continues against dandelions. This morning, a pre-dawn raid. 50 of them went down in 20 minutes. As Patton might say, I went through those dandelions like crap went through a goose, and I'm feeling good about it, Taylor.
Did you count all 50 of them?
Oh, yeah.
You, like, lay them out for a body count?
See, I had a discussion about this with my neighbor yesterday, who I'm competing with for the best lawn in the neighborhood, and he said, you know, I started counting the dandelions because you've been telling me that you've been counting them. He said, I stopped at three. I'm like, what's the point of counting the dandelions? But for me, it's you know, a manifestation of my work. That's how I'm keeping track of it. Plus, I can't count at bats. I can't count innings. I can't count. I'm looking for things to count, and right now it's the dandelions.
You should ask Tim Kirkchen what scorebook he uses and buy one of them and then keep track of how many dandelions you pull in that book.
I didn't even think about that. I'm going to keep a dandelion notebook. Oh, you're right. All right. It's appropriate conversation because today, as we continue Contributors Week, we'll be talking with the head of grounds at Fenway Park, David Miller, and I'll ask him about dandelion warfare and also some stories about his time in his work. And Paul Ambikides will jump in with a treetop on the latest news. First, some of those notes. We heard from Baltimore's outfielder Trey Mancini yesterday, who revealed that he's recovering from stage 3 colon cancer and doubts he will play this season if Major League Baseball returns. The 28-year-old made the announcement in his story he wrote for the Players Tribune. He will also speak later today with members of the media in Baltimore. Major League Baseball is allowing teams to offer refunds to fans for games currently not being played because of the coronavirus pandemic. Previously, games were considered postponed instead of canceled, allowing teams to hold on to revenue generated from ticket sales. The Pirates are suspending retirement benefits for members of the team's baseball operations staff in an effort to cope with the economic fallout of the pandemic. General Manager Ben Cherington said Tuesday that the team has been searching for ways to find savings with the 2020 season on hold. I heard about this, that owner Bob Nutting has been looking for ways to save money, and this is the route that they have chosen. USA Today reported that it appears the Hall of Fame ceremonies for 2020 will be postponed. The Hall of Fame board will talk on Friday with an announcement likely to come Friday or perhaps Monday. One of the alternatives being considered is to just postpone the 2020 ceremonies and fold them into 2021. By the way, in the regular writers voting, it looks like one candidate is likely to get in this winter, former pitcher Curt Schilling. And Bob Nightingale of USA Today also reported on the three-division format that Major League Baseball is considering. We'll get to that in a moment. And before we get to Dave and Hembo, a reminder that the SVP pod presses on through the pandemic. This week, SVP and Stanford Steve discussed Dennis Rodman taking a midseason vacation to Vegas and the Pistons not shaking hands with the Bulls after losing. Plus, Scott yells at Stanford Steve and Big Cat over NCAA 14. And they talk to John Sally, Michael Wilbon, and Jackie McMullen. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Bye, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Ambikides, a researcher at ESPN who's a honcho on the show Get Up. He says he's a head honcho. We have not confirmed that. Hembo, every time, and Bob Nightingale wrote a story for USA Today about this, he dug more into the idea of three divisions, possibly if baseball restarts. And I feel like every time one of these stories is published, what is lost is the context through no fault of the writers. Just because it's published, it carries a weight that maybe it doesn't necessarily have because they're talking about so many different plans, and each has to be discussed. Each has to be vetted. Each has to be broken down. Each has to be explored. They're incredibly fragile because, as one executive said to me yesterday, if they restart baseball and one person gets infected, then they have to shut down like the Utah Jazz did back in March. And the best comparison to me is hydroxychloroquine, that drug has been mentioned in the fight against the coronavirus. It's one possible solution, but they need to be studied. They need to be vetted. They need to look at different elements of it. And because it's one thing being discussed doesn't necessarily mean, as we learned with hydroxychloroquine, that it is actually a solution. What do you think?
We're so eager for solutions, and that's why we're so eager to jump at the possibility that baseball might return in whatever format as soon as possible. But I think that you're right in saying that, with no fault of the writers, a lot of these ideas are, for lack of a better term, pipe dreams. And because we're so eager, they're almost being interpreted by the public as reporting. And that's just not the case. I think if I were running Major League Baseball, I would obviously be doing the same stuff in terms of outlining all the possible scenarios. And that's good. I'd probably be a little bit more vigilant in ensuring that I probably leaked a little bit less, or at the very least, provided information to the people I wanted to that was a little bit more on the reasonable side and a little bit less on the really type side. Because a lot of these things that I read are just so out of the question, at least based on where the world is now, that it seems to me sort of a waste of time. I think Major League Baseball should be focusing on a couple things here in particular. The first, how can we limit travel as much as we possibly can? Obviously, the bubble city, those host type cities, a format like that, whether it would be like a World Cup style round robin or whatever the case may be. Jeff Passan was on Get Up Today talking about that. I think it's sort of the foundation of something that could work. You obviously have to limit the travel. But the second thing, I would focus in on the assumption that we're not going to play in front of fans. Well, what we need to do is have a plan in place for whenever that does happen, whenever we can play games, and Lord willing that we can, to enhance that experience as much as possible, Buster. Everything's on the table. Something as wild as getting ballpark food delivered to you, to your home while you're watching a baseball game sometime in August should be on the table. So if I were Major League Baseball, those two things, the limiting of travel and the in-game watching experience from your television should be the two things you should be focused on.
All right. We've had a great parade of contributors on the podcast so far this week. That'll continue in a moment with David Meller, who's the head of grounds for Fenway Park. On Friday, we will be talking with Jana Marie Smith, who, of course, was the person, the architect who designed Camden Yards. And I know Todd Radom, I feel the same way, believe that she should be honored at the Hall of Fame because that ballpark was a crossroad, I think, in fan experience. What do you think?
Buster, the best compliment that I can provide a new stadium that I visit for the first time is it reminds me of Camden Yards. There are so many things about it that you'll see across the league now. And though it's only, it was built in 92, it's less than 30 years old. Two thirds of the stadiums in the league have been replaced. And there are a few things I'd like to point out just in my travels that I would say remind me of Camden Yards. And in all cases, it's a good thing. The exterior brick facade is very similar at Citizens Bank Park. It was the first thing that I thought when I went to my first Phillies game. In Minneapolis, Target Field, Baltimore has that beautiful skyline. The way that the field is positioned is so perfect and strategic. That was my thought when I was sitting up in the 400 level at Target Field. It reminds me of Camden Yards. They had these open concourses. These old stadiums, Buster, were often very cramped, and the concourses were very challenging to maneuver. Camden Yards, its footprint was huge in relation to some of those older ballparks, and it reminds me a lot of Great American and SunTrust Park in Atlanta. And lastly, I think the coolest thing about the stadium, and I think a lot of people agree, is the warehouse. The way that it's positioned, and its sightline in relation to the field is so smart. And obviously in San Diego, Petco has the warehouse in left field that's built into it in a similar way. And I think that's really cool that they were able to use the building that was already in place to be a part of the ballpark experience. And I have to say the warehouse is probably going to go down as one of the more iconic things that's ever been put in any ballpark because of the Cal Ripken streak. Like when you see the numbers changing on the warehouse as he approaches and then breaks Lou Gehrig's, that is an extraordinary thing, Buster. And, to have the ingenuity to think of that and then years down the road, it be able to be executed in that way is a truly brilliant thing that I don't think can be overstated.
No, I agree. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. And on Monday, we're going to talk with Jeff Idelson, former president of the Hall of Fame. We're going to get a lot of his stories, and he's got a ton of them. What's your take on the in relation to the Hall of Fame right now?
Well, people ask me what my dream job is, Buster. And what I usually say is I would like to be, you know, the shortstop for the Phillies. Given the fact that's probably, at this point, unrealistic as I approach my age 30 season, being a Hall of Fame president, which is what he was formerly, would be up there on my list. To be able to, you know, to play golf with those guys and to be, you know, fraternizing at the Otisago. Like, that is sort of like the dream for someone like me and for a lot of other baseball fans. And I think I have to give him credit. The Hall of Fame receives a lot of criticism, and some of it's fair for the way that they, you know, the way that the last 10 or 15 years have gone, specifically as it relates to the steroid users. But I think that's a good thing, Buster, because what it tells me is that people care about the Baseball Hall of Fame way more than all of the other ones. And there's real value in that. The stringent process for election and the way in which the voting goes is so much better and more controversial in baseball than any other sport. And that's why the Baseball Hall of Fame is infinitely better than any other sport. And I think you'd agree with me in saying this. Every baseball fan and every baseball writer should visit it at least once, because it does provide you a different perspective. I'm so tired of hearing the arguments, it's just a museum. That is not the case. The Baseball Hall of Fame is not just a museum. It is part of the Baseball Hall of Fame. But the plaque room is holy ground. And the way that I view the plaque room is very different. Pete Rose is represented in the Baseball Hall of Fame museum, but he doesn't have a plaque. And the distinction there is very important. It's something that you don't really feel unless you're in the building.
All right, you and I are going to have an argument next week then, because I have uttered that line about it being a baseball museum and that whole – I mean, when people use the word holy, that's where they cross the line for me. But you know what? We will hit on that next week. Thanks for doing this, Sambo.
I'm looking forward to it. I'll bring my incense.
David Meller is the head of grounds for Fenway Park. He's also the author of a book published last year, One Base at a Time, How I Survived PTSD and Found My Field of Dreams. And Dave, I was noticing on Amazon a bunch of reviews, and pretty much all of them 5 stars. Like, I've done a couple books. I didn't come close to those type of reviews.
Oh, I'm very humbled. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast. You know, I'm very humbled by the response we've received. You know, we wrote the book with the thought that if we could help one person learn from our challenge, it was worth writing. And the response has been very powerful.
So tell me, in your interaction with folks, a reaction that you got that really stuck with you, one person who connected with the book and came up to you and talked to you about it.
You know, it has just been really the response we've heard from people in all walks of life. From, you know, when the first book signing, we had two people drive up from Washington, D.C. One was in the CIA. One was an FBI agent who had been dealing with PTSD and came to see us. We've had people from Highway Patrol, from firemen, from people who have dealt with sexual abuse to rape, to fires in their own home, to car crashes, to all sorts of trauma in their life. And I had someone reach out to me 2 weeks ago who was dealing with PTSD from COVID. And, you know, we want to let people know that they're not alone, that help's available, and that treatment works. You know, it's nothing to be ashamed of to ask for help. You know, for over 20 years, I kept all my emotions deeply buried inside because I thought it was a sign of weakness to ask for help. And now I know it's a sign of strength to ask for help. And the response we've gotten from the book is shown that people can relate to that. And, there, you know, we have resources in the book to let people know that, you know, PTSD doesn't just come from war. It comes from any life-threatening trauma, and it's a natural response to to trauma. And there is help available.
And I thought all along, when I first started talking to you about this and you mentioned that you wanted to write a book, I thought, boy, you are in a perfect position to connect with people because of your work and the fact that Fenway Park is so recognizable, and because of baseball, that people can relate to you, you know, through those avenues. Is that what you've experienced?
It really has. You know, the first ESPN E60 piece that we did with you, literally the very next day, the Red Sox were in town, and a visiting player, I walked out of my office and my office is right across the concourse from the visiting clubhouse. And a player from the visiting team was coming in from the team bus and stopped me and said, David, you know, my teammates and I saw the piece last night, and I wanted to stop you and tell you, thank you for having the courage to share your story. Because of you sharing your story, you know, many of my teammates and I realize that it's not a sign of weakness to ask for help, and that many of us are going to see our team psychologists also, and realize it's a sign of strength to ask for help. If you can do it, we can do it.
That's really great. And I see all the time when I'm out on the field that players will, you know, stop by and, you know, they'll say hi to you as they walk by. And I'm curious about in your time, in your position, a story about a, you know, a player that you connected with, a player who's you see and, you know, makes a point of coming by and saying hi.
You know, I've been very blessed. This will be my, 36th year in the majors. And I've been really fortunate to meet, you know, some great players through the years, you know, it not only guys that have great stats through the years, but just, you know, great people, from Robin Yount to Rick Porcello, just people, in all stages of their career. I've just been really fortunate to, make some friendships with guys that, like I say, they all put on their pants the same way we do and have life outside of baseball. So I've been fortunate to, make connections with guys and you know, stay in touch with them. A lot of them will stop over to the office to see Drago. Lance McCullers a lot of times will stop over to say hi to Drago, and you know, made friends that way too.
And if you can just explain for listeners who Drago is and when you met Drago.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Drago is my service dog. Drago came into my life May 9th, 2014. Drago is my service dog. He helps me with post-traumatic stress, as well as mobility. And, he goes everywhere with me. Other than right now during COVID, he stays at home, if I happen to go out of the house, but, he's trained not to go to the bathroom on grass. And so he goes, everywhere on the field with me. And, he is just absolutely, other than my wife, he's my best friend, and he's on the field with me, and a lot of the players will stop over to say hello and get to know him, and he's really been an important part of my life.
I'm pretty sure that he's a German Shepherd, right? We had German Shepherds, and I'm assuming that's what he is.
He is. I'm sorry. Yeah, he's a German Shepherd. He's 7.5 years old, and he has literally he's changed my life. He's an important part of my life, and you know. There's another ESPN feature called Dave and Drago that if you're interested, you can find a lot more information on how he's touched my life than that.
Yeah. And he is a great personality, and I see players come over and pat him all the time. I'm guessing also a lot of your connections with folks on the field through the years have been through the weather, you know, with the storm fronts coming in, that sort of thing. If you had any stories about managers or umpires that you've gotten to know a little bit, through your work in that regard.
Yeah. You know, some of my best friends are umpires who I've gotten to meet through the years. And, you know, one of the first things I look at in the morning, other than my wife and Drago, is weather. And one of the last things I've, look at is weather, and we have some great, forecasters. So really get to work with weather, and shout out to all my coworkers who have helped make connections with that. And, you know, different people, you know, through the years, really are into weather. I remember Joe Kerrigan, pitching coach, was into weather. I've heard Mike Trout is into weather, although I've never talked to him yet about that. And, you know, it's interesting. David Price was always interested in weather apps, but, you know, speaking of weather, I remember this morning I saw on Twitter on MLB Cathedrals, they talked about, they had a picture of a flood at County Stadium on June 21st, 1997, in which County Stadium flooded, in which I think we got over 4 inches of rain that night, overnight, in which, you know, the forecast was for a thunderstorm. So we put the tarp on overnight, but the rain did what was called training, where it just kept raining over same line of path of travel over Milwaukee, in which it just didn't stop. And so the water kept rising and rising, and County Stadium was kind of in a low spot, and it came in from the parking lots and just flooded the park. But through the hard work of the crew, the water drained away. And while that day's game was rained out, we were able to get the field ready for the next day. And this, once again, it was just a lot of teamwork. And that was a fun experience and fun to be part of.
How, in that situation, how long did it take you to get the field ready? We had a game on a Sunday in Wrigley Field last year, and I can't remember the circumstances, but they basically had to play. And so for 2 days, the Brewers and the Cubs essentially played in a steady rain. And I remember talking with the grounds crew there about how many tons of material that they put on the field. They literally replaced the infield overnight in terms of the material that went in there. So in that situation, when you guys had that flood in Milwaukee and you're working, how many hours did that require and the amount of labor involved?
You know, it was a lot of labor. Fortunately, there was the field had a crown to it. So the high part of the field was the infield skin. So the infield skin stayed pretty much dry, but the outfield and home plate were soaked. We actually brought in a helicopter from, I believe it was local Channel 4. And as long as they were not having to cover an emergency around the city, we had a groundskeeper in the helicopter cab with a radio, and they flew over different parts of the field. We would communicate with them on different parts that were wetter than others. And they literally hovered over the field for, I think, 6 to 8 hours, kind of like a big hairdryer. The downdraft from the helicopter was, I think, 140, 150 miles an hour. And we helped, you know, blow dry the field. And it was just a lot of teamwork to get it ready. You know, while some other rain games, you know, here, the old field, when I came to Fenway Park, did not drain well. It was the most antiquated field in baseball at that time. The last major renovation, when I came to Fenway in 2001, last major renovation to the field was 1934. It did not have subsurface Jeez. Drainage. So when it would rain hard, being on landfill, water would be wicked up from the bottom, as well as the water from the top would not drain away. So we would often put 10 tons of drying agent on top of the grass. And then the next day, take backpack blowers, blow a lot of that drying agent off and save it for a future day. And so it was a lot of challenges with the old field. Ownership invested in a new field that was put, a modern field that was put in after the 04 World Series. And so unfortunately, the new field does drain a lot. Certainly a lot of teamwork keeping fields going with Mother Nature.
Well, and you told me a story once about how the old field, that the drainage would back up so much that there would be fish near second base at Fenway Park.
You know, that is a great story. When I first started at Fenway, I sat down with Mr. Joe Mooney, who was the groundskeeper at Fenway for 30 years. And one of the first days we sat down, we were talking about how ballparks were similar and different. And Joe said, you know, David, when it really rains hard, the dugouts will flood because of the infield crown. And I said, okay, Mr. Mooney, you know, I'd seen dugouts flood before. And he said, if it really, really rains hard, the water from the street outside the park will back up from a thunderstorm and come underneath the city drain, and the manhole cover in the concourse will flood, and the whole third base concourse will fill up with water. And I said, that's a lot of water. And he said, if it really, really, really rains hard, the first base camera pit will back up with water from the city streets and fill all the way to the top with water. And the fish from the Charles River, which is about a mile away, will swim through the city drain pipes and swim out on the field. Well, this was in January of 2001, so I just thought Mr. Mooney was pulling my leg. And I went home and told my wife, you won't believe the stories that Mr. Mooney tells. Well, fast forward that year in April, we opened early April on a Monday. And on Friday night, we were supposed to get a couple inches of rain, so we put the tarp on Friday before opening day. And sure enough, we got close to 3 inches overnight. So Saturday morning when it stopped raining, I went out to the edge of the tarp early morning around 7, and sure enough, we had close to 3 inches of rain. I walked behind home plate on the warning track, got near the first base dugout, and there was a fish about 5-6 inches long. I thought, oh my gosh, Mr. Mooney set me up for a joke 3 months ago. So I looked up in the upper deck and yelled his name, and I couldn't find him anywhere. And I walked over to the camera pit, and sure enough, it was full to the top with water. And I looked between the camera pit and the second base position. There were 7 more fish on top of the tarp. Absolutely true story. I wish I would have dry mounted a fish for my office, for his office, for ownership. But the sun came out and the rush of getting ready for opening day, we threw the fish away. But luckily, I took a picture of the fish and it hangs in my office at Fenway.
Oh, that's awesome. I was going to say, you know, like the Boston Globe would absolutely love that. Pictures of fish on the field at Fenway Park.
Isn't that crazy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, you've given me the tour of Fenway Park and different parts of it. I've been lucky enough through my work to go, for example, inside the Green Monster in left field. I'm curious, in your time being at the park, has there been like a person you've enjoyed giving a tour to, with a celebrity? I'm sure that through the years, some people who work in politicians or in politics might have done that, or maybe some former players, because Fenway Park is such a unique place.
You know, I've had the honor to meet a lot of incredible people and veterans and people, you know, from the Jimmy Fund. Really very humble to meet a lot of people. And I remember my first year, there was a gentleman in the stands that I got called over to meet, and his name was David Brashear. And it turned out he had climbed Mount Everest at that time 4 different times. And someone asked me if I could walk him out to the field. He was a huge Red Sox fan. And so I walked him out to the field, and that day we were working on the pitcher's mound. I said, would you like to stand up on the pitcher's mound and get a picture? And he got to the edge of the mound and took a deep breath, and he says, you know, I have chills running through me. He says, I have more emotions running through me to climb up that 10-inch mound than I ever had climbing up Mount Everest. And I just literally, it kind of gives me chills right now just to think how special, you know, Fenway Park's mound is. You know, my dream was always to stand on Fenway Park's mound, and I get chills every day I walk on the field. And just to think, you know, somebody who's climbed Mount Everest 5 times now, you know, has that kind of feeling for Fenway, really put things in perspective again for me, how special Fenway is.
Yeah. And as soon as you said his name, I was thinking, is that, you're talking about the climber who was in the book Into Thin Air and part of that move in the, that was shot. That's incredible.
Exactly. Exactly. And I'll just always remember that day when a gentleman came here and I don't know if he remembers saying that, but it struck a chord with me. And like I say, I've met some incredible, like I say, wounded warriors and veterans and incredible children from the Jimmy Fund and, you know, like you say, politicians and athletes and just some wonderful people who help us pregame. And I just happen to remember that quote, that, you know, Fenway has an aura to it. And, I get chills every day I walk on Fenway's field, and I always remember that quote.
Now, you got into this in part because you love baseball, and I was thinking about this today, that in 2004, when the Red Sox had that incredible comeback to beat the Yankees, they finished that series on the road. When they won the World Series that year, they finished the World Series on the road in St. Louis in 2007. They finished that on the road, if I remember correctly. In 2013, though, they wrapped up the World Series at home. So I'm wondering what you remember from that moment and where you were, because your office is down inside Fenway Park and you wouldn't necessarily be at the edge of the field. But in that moment when they wrapped up the World Series in Fenway, where were you and what do you remember?
You know, I remember coming out of the dugout, and it was just magical. And, you know, we had to set up the infield to get the MVP truck on the field. And for that celebration, you know, with the crew, the ground crew hustled out and set that up. And then shortly after that was set up, my daughter and wife were able to make it down to the edge of the field, and security let them out there. And so that was really special to have my wife and daughter be able to celebrate on the field with me.
That's awesome. Before you go, I wanted to ask you, and I thought about this morning, this spring, because I have nothing else to do, I've decided I'm going to make the best lawn in Westchester County, New York.
There you go.
And so every morning I'm out at dawn fighting dandelions. And as I prepared myself to ask you this question, I'm like, oh, my God. He probably has so many people asking him so many questions about lawn care all the time. It's like a doctor being asked for advice on handle a headache or something like that. Before you answer the questions about dandelions, how often do people ask you questions like that about their lawn?
Oh, you know, that's fun. A lot of people ask me questions about turf care and lawns. And, you know, that's fun part of the job. And, you know, you ask me about dandelions. I'll tell you a funny story. You know, when I was in college, I couldn't wait to get my first home lawn. You know, I dreamed of, you know, I was dating my wife and we had plans to get married, and I couldn't wait to get my first home lawn. I wanted it to be like a pool table with not a weed in sight. And then when we got our first lawn, we had our two daughters and they taught me through their eyes how they would pick, they would find dandelions on the side of the yard and pick these bouquets of dandelions. And they just thought these dandelions were beautiful with these curly stamens in the middle of the flower. And when the dandelions would go to seed and be that big puffy ball, they would, they called them blow flowers, and they would chase each other and they would make a wish, and then they would blow the seed heads all over the yard and giggle and run around. And if we could find clover, we would sit for, it seemed like hours, looking for four-leaf clovers and making necklaces out of the flowers and the stems. And I quickly realized if they were happy, I was happy. And my war on weeds was over. And so literally my favorite flower right now and ever since has been a dandelion. In fact, I posted a picture on my Instagram account just the other day of a dandelion. And so when I see a dandelion now, it makes me smile. It brings back wonderful memories. And, you know, like life, lawns are all about tolerance. You know, it doesn't have to be the lawn sign in your yard, keep off my grass. Lawns are all about creating memories, you know, and you know, it's about having a healthy, actively growing lawn, invest in quality grass seed. You know, you get what you pay for. You know, invest in quality grass seed. Now is a great time to change the oil in your lawnmower, sharpen your mower blades. In fact, get a second set of mower blades, and once a month, change your mower blades. You know, we sharpen our blades regularly and check our blades every day we mow, because, you know, we have a clean field. At home, you're hitting sticks and acorns and walnuts and dog toys, and those ding up your blades and make your blades not sharp. So you think of cutting your hair or shaving with a dull blade, that, you know, is not good for your hair, let alone your grass. So if you cut your grass with a dull blade today, it may look green when you mow it, but tomorrow it'll look brown because all those grass blades are going to be shredded and those ends dry up. And they do two things. It'll dry your grass out quicker, and those sores on the grass open it up for disease and it's going to be injuries to your grass. And then now's a great time to do a soil test on your grass, on your soil. And that's easy to do. You can contact your county extension agent and do a soil test, and that'll tell you the percent sand, silt, and clay in your soil. And also a nutrient analysis. And you can use that as a base. It'll give you recommendations on what you need for fertilizer. Never think a little bit's good. A lot must be better with whatever fertilizer you use, whether it's organic or synthetic. And never think, you know, I have a half a bag left over, I'm going to go ahead and use it on my lawn, or I'm going to throw it in the trash. And always be respectful that you're not spreading some on your driveway and leaving it there to wash down your down into the street or into the gutter. You know, follow the label on whatever bag of product you're using. The label's the law, so be respectful there. The spring is a good time to core aerate. Now it's still pretty chilly out. It's been a chilly spring, certainly in the Northeast. You can seed in the spring. The best time to overseed is in the fall because the soil is warm. The fall frost, you know, September in the Northeast is a good time. The fall frost will take care of weeds. But you can certainly seed now coming up and when it warms up just a little bit. Once again, follow the label on whatever fertilizers you're using. You have lots of options on weed control. You can mechanically take it out. You could use corn gluten for an organic crabgrass control. Or, you know, when it comes to clover and dandelions, you could leave it. You could spot spray. You don't have to go out and broadcast something on your whole lawn. But, you know, it's certainly, once again, it's about tolerance and, you know, thinking about the environment when you care for your lawn.
Feeling a little guilty about my war on dandelions now after hearing your story, David. But see, I create memories. My memories for my son now about dandelions are going to be about sending him out to gather 100 every day. That's his assignment. Oh, boy. I always love talking with you. I always learn something. David, I appreciate your time.
Well, I sure appreciate all your support and hope the book One Vase at a Time can be of support to people while they're going through these challenges with COVID.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Quick one here. Adam Smith at Schmitty FIA writes in, first of all, love the conversation with Bob Kendrick. Enjoy hearing about baseball museums and their
collections. Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, he was incredible. And he wants to know, I guess, really unrelated to this, could you tell us the story of how/why you became a Vikings fan?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I got my first football cards, like baseball cards. And one of the cards was Gene Washington, who was a wide receiver for the Vikings at that time. And I just liked the logo. I thought the logo was cool. And it probably didn't hurt that at that time, that team was pretty good. They had the Purple People Eaters, Alan Page and Carl Eller and Jim Marshall. And they were successful, I thought, because, of course, now they played in 4 Super Bowls and they've been beaten every time. But I love the logo and I am a crazy Vikings fan.
Love Kirk Cousins. Last one for today. And really just a comment here. Tim writes in, hey, Buster, the Fiskars 4 Claw Weeder is the best purchase I've ever made for lawn care. I love the pod.
A lot of dandelion. Tim, after I saw your Bleacher tweet, I went online. I watched YouTube and how that works. And all I can say is for all my neighbors and family members, they'll be getting a present courtesy of you. I've ordered a lot of the 4 Claw Weeder, including one for my son. I'm trying to figure out how to put a Titans logo on one to make him really like it.
That is it for Bleacher tweets for today. And just a heads up, you know, these are lean times. We don't have a ton to talk about. So, Bleacher tweeters, now's the time to get your questions in. We're talking weeds and Vikings today. So ask whatever you want and it'll probably make it into the pod.
All right. Thanks for listening today. Have a great day and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.